You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, recent flooding across the Midwest has caused billions of dollars in damage, and it's also meant major setbacks for industries like farming. Levees are used in many communities to control flooding, but our guest says they may be making things worse. Right now, it's time for our weekly review of state news with reporters from around the state. First, the Marathon County Board voted this week to uphold its recent decision declaring June as Pride Month, but some board members reconsidered their stance along the way. Laura Schulte is a reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Back in June, Laura, the board voted that June would be known as Pride Month in Marathon County. Can you talk about what happened next that got us to this second vote?
Yes. So a few hours before last week's informational meeting, one of the board members submitted a reconsideration. But due to some legal reasons, Robert's Rules of Orders and state statutes, they couldn't put that on the agenda just a few hours before the meeting. They need a 24-hour notice. So it came up at the action meeting on Thursday, the meeting where they normally take votes, which meant there was no public comment allowed. And they revisited that conversation without any input from the public based on the reconsideration of a board member who had a voted yes originally but wanted to change his mind because his constituents, largely from one of the more rural areas of Marathon County, his constituents were upset about the vote yes.
Now, can you talk a little more about what board members heard after initially declaring Pride Month in Marathon County?
A lot of the board members said they got a lot of positive feedback, but especially in the more rural parts of the county, board members were getting really negative feedback, a lot of which was very religiously based. People were really upset, and they thought that it singled out one part of the population without giving any recognition to any other parts of the population.
And did you write, at least one board member said that they had received death threats as part of this?
Yes. Board member Kahlo said that she had gotten some death threats, and that was one of the religious emails or letters that she received. And that said, everybody who voted in the affirmative for the Pride Month resolution should die because of that.
And what was ultimately the result of this reconsideration vote?
The reconsideration, it didn't pass. There were 2 hours of pretty tense conversation surrounding it. We heard a lot of religious references in there. A lot of people saying that it shouldn't happen. But ultimately, the board pretty much voted the same way that they had. Two more board members were present than the original meeting. So actually, that was two more votes in the negative. But it was upheld. It was a very narrow three vote gap there. So it was very narrow.
Let's turn now to another story you covered this week. A Wausau resident says she was the victim of a racist attack. It's gotten the attention of local officials and the community. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes. Sadia Hussein has lived in Wausau for about 5 years, and she was out for a walk early last week near Oak Island. She says she does this a lot. She, you know, walks around there. And while she was walking, a couple pulled up in a truck and asked her where the projects were. And she said she didn't understand the question, so she asked them to clarify. And they asked her, where do all the poor people like you live? Following that, the woman took the top off of a cup and threw a liquid on Sadia. During the press conference this week, she said she wasn't sure what it was. She at first thought it was acid because she's seen news stories like that. Ended up just being water. They yelled some expletives at her, and she started walking back from Oak Island towards Thomas Street, and she said the truck made a few more passes by her. She did end up getting a photo of the truck, and the truck is a gray Toyota Tundra, and it had Texas temporary plates with a partial number of 8 and 4, according to the Wausau police.
Now, Hussein had talked about this on social media and then again at a press conference. What kind of reaction is this getting now from local officials?
Obviously, there's been a lot of condemnation. A lot of people are very upset that this is happening in the community, saying that we need to come together and combat problems with racism in the community. you know, obviously the WASA police, the police chief, Ben Bliven, was actually present at the conference and spoke. And he's encouraging people who are victims of sensitive crimes like hate crimes. He's urging them to come forward. He said that Sadia was very brave, and it's a good thing that she came forward. They're trying to find the people who did it. And other things, some of the officials are calling for more racial education, more sessions educating the white members of the community about complicit bias and racism and stuff like that.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Laura Schulte is a reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. She talked with us about a racist attack on a Wausau woman and the Marathon County Board's decision to keep June designated as Pride Month. Now, Milwaukee has approved a pilot program of electric dockless scooters in the city. Comes after more than a year of debate about whether to allow rental scooters, which have been showing up in urban areas around the country. Jeremy Janine is president and co-founder of the online daily Urban Milwaukee. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's been quite a ride to get here, Jeremy, with back and forths over scooters, whether they'd be allowed, how they'd be allowed. Can you give us a quick history of this scooter effort in Milwaukee?
Absolutely. The first day of Summerfest last year, without announcement, President Trump was also in Milwaukee for a visit, and Bird, one of the couple of venture capital-backed scooter providers operating on an international level, dropped off approximately 100 scooters on city streets. To unlock them, all you had to do was download a smartphone app, scan the scooter, and you could go riding with a cheap, I think it was 15 cent per minute fee. Well, the catch became that the city of Milwaukee wanted to know what their regulatory authority was. They quickly explored this, given that there was scooters all over the sidewalk. There were scooters all over people driving them in the street. Some people loved them. Some people hated them. But the big catch was that they were not legal under state law. There's a bunch of classifications of different vehicles under Wisconsin statutes, most of them being agricultural equipment, like the ability to drive a tractor on a state highway. But scooters, just like Segways had to be in the early 2000s, needed to be defined. And so after a lawsuit was filed by the city of Milwaukee at Bird, Bird voluntarily retracted their scooters from the city streets. And the legislature, as we all know, had a big election in the fall, and that put things on hold. Finally, they came back just a couple weeks ago and approved legislation to legalize them at the state level. And that brought forward a Milwaukee program, a pilot program, to allow them again on the streets of Milwaukee and other cities.
Now we have this company, Lime Scooter, and it sounds like, unlike the one you just mentioned, they actually went to the city first before they started dropping scooters on the streets.
Yes, Lime had hired a lobbyist last year already at the same time Bird entered the Milwaukee market, but took the tactic of, we'll wait to make sure we have complete regulatory approval, where Bird went ahead and just deployed the scooters. They're both expected to be back this year, but Lime is now here legally through the pilot program.
And you mentioned these scooters in cities around the country. It's been a love-hate scenario here. Some people like these things. Some people are just annoyed at their existence. What kind of rules and guidelines are going to be in place in this pilot program?
And the biggest thing about that is sidewalks. The scooters can go up to 15 miles per hour. So if that's coming down the sidewalk at you, yeah, you're probably not going to like that. And so the Milwaukee pilot and a new ordinance they passed bans sidewalk riding. There's up to a $100 fine. But the council realizes that given Milwaukee's challenges, they don't want to see the police department's time tied up arresting people biking on the sidewalk. So there's a big public push by the city and through the media to have people not ride on the sidewalks voluntarily, to use bike lanes and other streets where possible.
And there are also always questions about, where do these things get parked? Are people just hopping off and leaving them? What's the company, what's the city doing to try to make sure that scooters aren't littering the city?
Yes, as part of the pilot program, that's a bit of a gray area right now. There's no clear, hard and fast rule on that. But what Lime does is, when you end your ride, you have to take a photo of it. And Lime is then able to, if they find a scooter, if someone reports a scooter, takes a photo of it, they can ID who parked it last, determine if they parked it poorly, look back at the photo. They can also send suggestions to riders based on their technology. They say, that says, hey, it looks like you're parked in the middle of the sidewalk. Please, you know, get out of the way and leave plenty of space for people to get through. But that'll be something that the city has to closely monitor going forward, especially as hundreds and hundreds of scooters get deployed on city streets.
We'll watch for that. Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Janine is president and co-founder of the online daily Urban Milwaukee. He talked to us about electric scooters coming to the city's downtown, and he wrapped up our weekly look at news stories from around Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at some of the problems with using levees for flood management and talk about other strategies to deal with the risk of flooding. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been 29 years since the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law, and today there are questions about how the law applies to things like websites, therapy animals, and people with a mental illness in the criminal justice system. A law professor joins us for a look at the past, present, and future of the civil rights law. First, flooding across the Midwest this spring caused billions of dollars in damage, destroying homes and businesses, and creating big problems for the area's farmers. But our next guest says one of the main tools we use to deal with flooding in the U.S., levees, may be making the problem worse. Amaya Molyar is an environmental historian at Drake University. Her latest piece for The Conversation is titled, As Flood Risks Increase Across the U.S., It's Time to Recognize the Limits of Levees. Amaya, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, pleased to be with you.
How much do we rely at present on levees in the United States as our main ingredient in our flood control system?
Well, levees are exactly that. They are the main ingredient, and they have been since the late 19th century. In fact, the United States Army Corps of Engineers, which controls navigable rivers and our levee system, maintains our levee system, has had what is we call a levees-only policy, which in short basically means that we have prioritized levees over other kinds of flood control.
And we have levees here in Wisconsin, but a lot of people may not see them every day. Levee just means basically we're building up both banks of the river. Is it that simple?
Yeah, it's an earthen embankment. It is a fairly simple infrastructure. They are more than just the hill that you see. They are packed earth that go down into the ground, many feet below ground as well. And they can be expensive to build and engineer, and they do need to be maintained.
Before we get into the risks they can create, are we doing enough to maintain them right now?
No, we are not. Right now, the American Society of Civil Engineers, they give a report card to our infrastructure in the United States. We are currently operating at a D with our levee system in the United States. So, no, we are not maintaining them. It will cost billions of dollars to maintain them. Many of our levees are 70, 80 years old and date to kind of our big dam era. So the New Deal until through the 1960s, which is when a majority of our river and infrastructure is built, whether that be flood control or reservoirs, dams.
In a recent piece you wrote, you say the issue isn't just that levees are old and unmaintained and at risk, though they are. It's also that the idea of relying on levees itself can create a risk. Why is that?
Yeah, I think we forget that in our attempt to protect ourselves from flooding, that we can actually exacerbate flooding. And so what we have seen as the number of miles of levees have expanded in the United States, and we're currently operating with an estimated over 100,000 miles of levees that are in all 50 states. What's happening is that we're constricting the river, and we have to remember that flooding is natural. Flooding is going to happen every single year or most years. Sometimes it's going to be extreme. And what levees do in theory, and the idea the engineers had in the 19th century, was that by constricting the water, they will cause it to flow deeper, higher, to scour the bottom of the river, and therefore to flow faster. And the idea was that it would just remove flood water more quickly. But that is mostly how it works in theory. At the scale of a watershed and the volume of water that that a flood brings, that doesn't work. And so what happens is that we're just concentrating the water in one place so that when you do have a levee breach or a levee is overtopped, it makes the flooding much worse for those places that were perhaps just passively and securely sitting behind a levee.
So if I'm living near a levee, it sounds like, okay, maybe in an ordinary year, I'm less likely to see any flood. But in a bad year, if there is a flood, it's going to be a bad flood.
Exactly. And so we're putting more and more people and property in harm's way, because not only is the risk for flooding increasing, but if that, you know, in a 1%, for example, chance that a levee were to fail or to breach, the flooding is going to be much worse because there is a much larger volume of water there.
How about if I'm living in a town, I don't have levees. My neighbors upstream do have levees. Is there a bad, I guess, trickle-down effect for me?
Yes, and that is part of what is exacerbating flooding, is that not all people are equal when it comes to levees. If you play in a sandbox, as some news outlets have been doing, National Public Radio has done this, Vox has done this, and ProPublica have made large-scale sandboxes, if you will, to play in and be able to show the way that levees can harm upstream and downstream communities that don't have levees. So, for example, if you create a bottleneck in your community by, let's say, a wealthier or newer community builds a nice high levee and they protect themselves, the water that is passing through there, it might get backed up behind and flood a nearby neighborhood, or it could get pushed at a higher level into the next community. So yes, levees can create flooding that is worse for communities up and downstream. And we do see across the United States that levees are not equally applied, that some communities can afford levees. And so we see more risk to working class communities, people of color, for example.
It seems like we see more and more reports of flooding around the United States, concerns about more intense weather events, thanks in part to climate change. Are we going to see our flood control systems, levees, or whatever we got, put to the test more in the years to come?
Absolutely. And it's a complex issue. It's not, there's not just one thing at work here, but climate change is the elephant in the room. And we know that climate change modeling for the Midwest, for example, shows that we're going to have more extreme weather events. So that when we have rain, the rain is going to come faster and harder, you know, that we'll have a 6-inch rainstorm overnight, for example. And what this means is that we have more water, more volume of water all at once. But this is made even more complex by the fact that our agriculture, you know, we've removed our wetlands in the Midwest, for example, that work like sponges. And most of our agricultural fields, especially corn and soy, they're not able to retain the water. And we've built an agricultural infrastructure called tiling that sends water more quickly out of fields, drains them quickly, therefore sending water to streams faster. Our urban areas operate similarly. Lots of impervious surfaces. So you've probably heard, if you disconnect your downspout, for example, let rainwater go into your yard as opposed to straight into a storm drain. If you just think of that on a much broader scale, this is what our cities are doing, sending water more quickly into our water systems. And so as we restrict our rivers, we see a larger volume of water, and it's running through an environment that has been engineered to shed that water more quickly. So when we add climate change to this built environment, our risk is increasing several fold.
Are there communities taking different approaches, approaches not built around levees that seem to be working better?
There are some communities that are recognizing that they need to treat their riverine environments differently. On a broader scale, we're starting to see cities like along the Missouri and the Mississippi River, putting more green space. We also saw after the 1993 flood, we saw national wildlife refuges that replaced farmland, for example, giving the river room to rise, a place for the floodwaters to go, recognizing that floods are natural. And if you let a floodplain be a floodplain, then your risk is reduced. And so as those high waters come through communities, communities can do something very similar. And the most significant example that we see in the Midwest is Davenport, Iowa, which is one of the quad cities on the Illinois-Iowa border where the Mississippi River runs through. And Davenport is a city of 100,000 people, and it's the only major city that has chosen not to build a levee. And that decision is proving to have been a good choice. And so what the city has done is it's created park space, green space, public space down by the river, which of course attracts people and creates places for recreation. So when the river rises, it is grassland, it is soccer fields, it is a promenade that is flooded instead of homes and businesses. The mayor of the city said, after a flood, Davenport just rinses off. And even some of its infrastructure downtown, its buildings, have begun to reorient themselves to this new kind of built environment. So famously, the Figge Art Museum, which is down on the riverside, is a world-famous art museum. And it is built so that the river can run underneath in flood time. And that's exactly what happened this year in 2019. The Mississippi River was in flood stage for basically 3 months. And for a large part of that, there was a river running underneath the art museum quite safely. All of its precious goods were one story up and high and dry.
We'll leave it there for now. Amaya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Amaya Milliar, environmental historian at Drake University, with us today to talk about why levees may not be the best way to control flooding and to share some alternative approaches when it comes to flood control. Coming up, the Americans with Disabilities Act is celebrating 29 years. We'll look at the past, present, and future of the law. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:15 on The Morning Show, it's peak season for a lot of great summer produce in Wisconsin, and you might be overwhelmed by all the veggies in your garden, your neighbor's garden, or the farmer's market. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests talk about great ways to make the most of the harvest. That's tomorrow, Monday morning at 7:15 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Americans with Disabilities Act turns 29 today, and it's affected the way our workplaces, communities, and culture look today. But there have been challenges over time. Courts today are considering questions about website compliance, service and therapy animal accommodations, and how people with mental illness are treated in our criminal justice system. Laura Rothstein is a professor of law and distinguished university scholar at the University of Louisville in the Louis D. Brandeis School of Law. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for recognizing this anniversary.
What kind of milestone was this law when it was passed?
Oh, it was huge. Before I had have actually been writing and working in this area for almost 40 years, and before the ADA, we did have the Rehabilitation Act, but it only applied to programs that received federal financial assistance. So it applied to most universities and a lot of healthcare systems, but the private sector, most employers, movie theaters, restaurants, hotels, kind of all of that, was not subject to any mandate not to discriminate on the basis of disability, nor were they required to provide reasonable accommodations. So the ADA was a significant change, and it took a lot of work for it to pass. I recently published an article about whether the ADA would pass today, which is unlikely for lots of reasons, but it is widely applauded, and President Bush said this was his proudest achievement during his tenure as president. So it was significant because it now meant that most private employers were covered and could not discriminate on the basis of disability. It meant that employees who wanted to go out to lunch with their friends who had disabilities, mobility impairments would be probably the most apparent one, could expect that the restaurants would need to be accessible, and so on and so on, and movie theaters. And so it was a major change. And of course, it took a while for everyone to sort of recognize, and some were better than others. But yes, it was big.
We hear sometimes people talk in terms of pre-Americans with Disabilities Act and post-ADA generations. How did this change our culture and the lives of people with disabilities?
Well, it changed our culture because once you were prohibited from discriminating, and the employment sector was probably the biggest, but it was also, think about the kinds of places we go every day. We go to movie theaters, we go to restaurants, we go to hotels, we go to entertainment centers, we go to museums. And now those were required to be accessible and provide accommodations, such as it may be captioning of a video or something of that sort. And so it meant that people with disabilities could now function in the world and find it a more welcoming place. And I don't want to pretend that it turned it around overnight, but it did make a big impact. And I think we can start seeing the impact it had on our culture in some of the television programs and the movies. A woman with a mobility impairment just received a Tony this past year. So the presence and participation has increased dramatically, and the awareness is significant. I think if you think about the fact that one in five Americans has a disability, but probably every American has either a family member or a friend or someone that they know with a disability, it has a huge impact. So it has made a big difference.
I've seen some people make the case that actually this ended up helping people without disabilities as well. My personal example is, accessibility to buildings. All of a sudden, when I had a double twin stroller, I was benefiting from a lot of these changes
that
myself.
That is the perfect example. In fact, I often use it sort of jokingly and saying, roller luggage wasn't rocket science. Why did it not get invented sooner? And if you start thinking about roller luggage became more common when you started having curb cuts everywhere. So it is absolutely a benefit. So it's those shopping carts. It is strollers. It is people bringing food into places for catering, and luggage, of course. So it has helped people without disabilities. The other thing, and this is more going to the special education law, but there are ADA implications there as well. The presence of young people in our schools with disabilities has really made everyone more aware and more understanding and empathetic about a whole range of disabilities.
Talking to law professor Laura Rothstein from the University of Louisville on the anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, there are a lot of legal frontiers to this day on the ADA, Laura, and one big one has to do with something that wasn't really there when it was passed, the internet and internet accommodations for people who access the internet maybe in different ways. What's going on?
Well, the internet, it's interesting because, of course, in 1990, we did have technology, but not like we have it today. And the technology is both a friend of people with disabilities and not a friend of people with disabilities. For people with mobility impairments, it means you can do all kinds of things, order products and so on from your home without necessarily having to go out to the store. But for a person who has a visual impairment, navigating a website, and if it is not an accessible website, is really daunting and a barrier. And so there started to be recognition that this was a barrier. And unfortunately, we don't yet have design standards. We know there are some guidelines and so on, but we don't have a federal mandate that if you are a provider of a website, you must make it accessible in these ways. There is, in fact, some litigation that says, well, websites aren't even subject to the ADA. I think that's most courts are saying that they are subject to the ADA. But the harder question then is, well, what does that mean that you have to do? So, for example, and this affects universities, it affects retailers, it affects museums, it affects pretty much anyone who has a website. And, do you have to, if you have a video on your website, do you have to provide closed captioning for everything? do you have to do everything that's archived? Make that accessible. If you have something that is linked to something else, are you a bulletin board, or do you have to make sure that's accessible, and so on? So those are the kinds of things that it's not just whether they're subject to the ADA, but what you have to do. And another challenge would be the small business owner. You want to, you know, open up your own business, and suddenly you're faced with somebody who is saying, well, you don't have an accessible website. And so I think it is an issue that would be tremendously helped if the federal government and the Department of Justice had started working on regulations on this. And I think there has been a strong cry for them to complete that. So at least it's like, okay, we know that we have to do this, but what does that mean? Kind of a parallel example would be several years ago, there was a Supreme Court decision that said cruise ships were subject to the ADA. But that didn't decide what that meant they had to do in terms of accessibility, because they had safety issues and they were unique vehicles. So that one is huge. There have been a very large number of lawsuits and complaints about websites, and so we're really kind of watching that. But I would say that's probably, in some ways, one of the hottest issues under the ADA right now.
A concern I've seen raised lately is that, okay, the ADA officially was intended to end employment discrimination, but people with disabilities tend to be unemployed at substantially higher rates than the rest of the population. Are there wrinkles? Are there problems here that are preventing the full implementation of employment laws?
Well, it varies a lot depending on who the employer is. And I think in some areas, and there is a National Resource Job Accommodation Network that is available to help employers know what to do in terms of accommodations. So that's really where if an employer might be worried about the accommodation. And then there's also the aspect of health insurance. And so that is a hidden challenge, because there may be a fear that someone with a disability is going to cost more in health insurance, so employers that provide that. So that's one of the other issues. The ADA has certainly improved the employment, but you are correct that it is still disparately, and especially people with severe disabilities are even more adversely affected. And so it's gotten better, but we do have improvements to be made.
Anecdotally, I've heard concerns that some people suspect that when you see a job application and it says you have to be able to lift X number of pounds, 50 pounds, say, or more for the job, people argue in some cases that's not essential to the job. It's an easy way to discriminate against a person with disabilities.
That can be raised. The employer has the burden of establishing that they put it out there, but if someone were to challenge that that's not really an essential function, then the employer would come back and say, well, yes, it is, and there's a whole set of factors in the regulations about how you determine. For example, a firefighter, even though they may not have to carry someone down a ladder very often, it's going to be real important that they be able to do that when it's needed. So that is, you know, how often do you have to do it? Are there other people available to do it, and so on? So that is possible in some job applications, but the burden is on the employer to demonstrate that it's an essential function, and then the employee has to demonstrate that they're able to carry it out. But they may be able to carry it out if they have reasonable accommodations.
Talking to Laura Rothstein, professor of law at the University of Louisville. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Has your life been affected by the ADA? Did it change your life? If so, how? If you are wondering what kind of accommodations you need to have, say, if you're an employer or have a store, you can call in as well. Are there further changes you'd like to see made? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Laura Rothstein of the University of Louisville, looking at the anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We talked to Democratic State Representative Jimmy Anderson from Wisconsin's 47th District this week about some legislation being introduced at the Capitol. During that conversation, he shared his thoughts about the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Yeah, I mean, it's pivotal. It's all about making sure that people get the proper accommodations that they request, and all they're asking for is simple dignity. I mean, they just want to be included in the process. And the ADA has been pivotal to making sure that people in the workplace have been able to get that dignity.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did the Americans with Disabilities Act change your workplace, your school, your community? Did it give you access, or a family member, access to those things? Do you see room for change now in this era? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Gina Maria is with us in Appleton.
Hello.
Hi, Gina Maria. What did you want to bring up?
Well, we have this wonderful body of legislation, but it doesn't help if hotels don't follow it. So on occasion, I travel by myself. I live by myself, and I'm a wheelchair user and have limited accommodations, but, you know, things work. And then when I travel on numerous occasions, you get there and look at the shower and fine, there's a bench to sit down, but the water is so far away that you can't manage the controls. So there's no enforcement body, and that's my concern.
Gina Maria, thanks for the call. If someone encounters that, say in this case at a hotel, Laura, what recourse, if any, do they have?
Well, the hotels are very important because they conventions meet there and so on. So I think large providers of conventions have an opportunity to leverage and to make sure that hotels do what they say they're going to do, because some of them hold themselves, yes, we have accessible hotel rooms, and then they're not truly accessible. There are specific design standards about what that means. So we want to be careful, because sometimes things aren't ideal, but they may still be in compliance. That's where you want to work to try to raise awareness about something that may be technically designed correctly just by common sense. It isn't going to work for someone. But if they're not even in compliance, you can bring a complaint, or, you know, you can kind of let it be known in you know, the internet world about, but there are concerns about if you're not correct and are you being defamatory and so on. But it is, I think some hotels are very good and some are not as good, and the marketplace will have some impact, but I think there is more that needs to be done with hotels. So you can bring a private case, and there are many state laws and local laws that also provide for this. But under the ADA, under Title III, an individual cannot get damages. They can only get attorney's fees, and they can get an injunction. So that's a bit of a barrier to complaining about that. But I think, you know, complaining to the management, especially of the large chains, they're more likely to hear that if there are lots of complaints. So I would encourage that person to keep letting it be known, and not just necessarily think about litigation, but complaining to or bringing that to the attention of the local manager. But sometimes if it's designed at a national level, they need to work on changing that. And, you know, talk about the places that are accessible and encourage people to go there instead of the places that aren't.
Gina Maria, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Anna with us in northern Minnesota. Anna, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Anna?
Yeah, so I actually just happened upon your radio program. I'm on a road trip. I have not really even heard of the ADA before, so I'm, like, completely new to the situation. But I thought I would love to call in and get some more information. My partner was actually recently disabled about a year and a half ago in a pretty serious motorcycle accident. He's lost the use of his left arm through some serious nerve damage. So he is navigating the world as a newly disabled person, and I'm his partner, so I'm trying to help him through it. And, you know, it's affected our lives pretty greatly. He recently went back to work in a retail position. I'm not going to name the employer right now, but I, first of all, I'm just curious what types of resources there are available to somebody in his situation who's kind of like new to this whole world. And also, I'm curious too, what types of things could be done. I guess he's kind of expressed to me that his new employer hasn't been totally understanding of his disability. I mean, he's wearing a sling. It's pretty obvious his arm doesn't work, but they're still having him lift stuff and not letting him sit down or take breaks. So he's actually talked to me a little bit about maybe leaving the job pretty soon because it's too hard physically. I'm just curious. I'm calling in to find out what kinds of things we could do for him or what I can learn to tell him.
Anna, thanks. Good luck to you and your partner. Laura, thoughts for somebody newly in this position, not sure what the laws or resources are?
Sure, and I think that's what's significant about the ADA, because any person right now could become a member of the group that's protected by this law because of an accident or an illness and so on. And we do tend to become more aware when we have a friend or a family member or someone we know. And the resource that's available in the employment setting is it's a national resource, and it actually has been in place since, I think, 1985. It's the Job Accommodation Network. I don't have the link to it, but I can give this to you afterwards if there are people that want to try to connect to that. And it provides employers and I think now also individuals about, let's say, I have a job working on a loading dock and I have limited, what kind of accommodations could there be? I work in retail, and what kind of accommodations could I request? Now, one of the challenges is, and there are a fair number of cases on this, is an employer isn't required to provide an accommodation if the person hasn't made known the need for that. But there is an argument that if someone has an apparent condition, the ADA does not cover temporary conditions, and there's a whole definition about what it means to be a temporary condition. It sounds like this caller, it's more than a temporary condition. So it may be that the individual needs to request that I have this limited mobility and I need X accommodation. The employee has to be able to carry out the essential functions of the job, but that takes into account reasonable accommodations. So, for example, if you would have, let's say, an employment setting where someone worked at a cash register, and they ordinarily do not allow water or food at the cash register for reasons of it doesn't look good and so on. But somebody is taking medication for a disability and it requires them to have water frequently. That may be that the employer should allow an exemption. And so that would be some, but if that isn't made known to the employer, that wouldn't be required. So it's real, the courts have been very specific about saying there should be an interactive process once there is an awareness. So there are resources, and in every situation is so dependent on what kind of job, what kind of impairment there is, and so on.
Thanks again for that call. Our producer gives me a number for that Job Accommodation Network, 800-526-7234. Their website is askjan.org, askjan as in Job Accommodation Network. Just our last minute or so, Laura, what is, do you expect to see Congress revisit this? Or are we going to be getting more clarification from courts? What are the next steps here?
I don't really expect Congress to revisit this. And the article I wrote talks a little bit about this. And I wrote an article about that there was a recent attempt to require that individuals had to make known, this would be in the architectural barriers area. Right now, I think the political climate is such that Congress is unlikely to do. They're not doing a whole lot about much of anything because of, you know, we've got kind of a challenging political times. But I think there's a concern that if you open up any major legislation like that to change, then it's going to open up a can of worms. So I don't really expect it to be amended. What I think would be very helpful is if there were new regulations on the websites. The Department of Transportation is now working on new regulations related to the animals on airplanes. One of the big issues that is we see in the news a lot are animals, especially on airplanes, but in other settings. And there are some regulations on those, but the airline setting is unique, and the Department of Transportation has recognized that. So I think we'll see some action in the regulatory world, but I think we'll continue to see lots and lots of court cases.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bye. Laura Rothstein, law professor at the University of Louisville. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the U.S. Justice Department says it's bringing back the death penalty for certain federal inmates. We'll look at the reasons behind that decision and the arguments for and against it. That and look at legal challenges to a pipeline in Wisconsin and Michigan and more coming up Monday on Central Time.